I keep reading about this period between the Testaments. I'm at the point now I've got to decide what not to discuss. There are so many fascinating stories, and some of them have a lot to do with the background of what we're getting into the New Testament. I'm going to try to cover those. There's a lot of others that don't quite dwell out, but they're so interesting. It helps prepare what Paul was facing when he went out across the Roman Empire preaching to the Greeks and what their mindset was that's developed through this time. So we're looking from Malachi to Matthew. But actually, I'm talking about more than that. I'm really talking about the end of the Old Testament that's going to carry us into the beginning of the New. And there'll be some things in Acts we'll need to bring in. But to really understand how the cultural changes that took place between those Old Testament cultures and these New Testament cultures. And it'll just place the New Testament in a context that I think will really help you appreciate that. Now, last week, we talked about Daniel chapter 2, when Nebuchadnezzar had this dream. And I thought this illustrated it pretty good with the head of gold. That's you, Nebuchadnezzar, the kingdom of Babylon. After you, the Medes and the Persians. I just think it's silver. It wasn't quite so glorious a kingdom. In some ways, it exceeded. But in other ways, it wasn't as rich. But I just think of the two arms, the Medes and the Persians coming together. I don't know if that was intended in that image or not, but it certainly does fit the Medes and the Persians coming together for that kingdom. And then the belly and thighs of brass. Now, this fella doesn't have brass thighs, so the image isn't exactly right. But that brass should go down to about that guy's knees there. The Greeks would fight with armor of brass. Even into the Iron Age, they would wear their brass helmets, I've been reading. I thought, boy, that fits this image so well to emphasize the brass. Now, that was probably better translated bronze. King James Version calls it brass. You've heard of the Bronze Age. It's followed by the Iron Age. And the Greeks had an early history in the Bronze. That's when you're getting back to Homer and the Iliad and Agamemnon and Odysseus. All that's in the Bronze Age, okay? And that age is over by the time we get here. But the Greeks continued to use brass helmets in their armaments. And I thought that was interesting. And then the legs of iron and feet with iron and miry clay. Now the Romans come in. The iron rule of Rome. I tell you, the Romans would say, you just cooperate with us and everything will be fine, but if not, buddy, they're going to stamp you out. That's the way those Romans ruled. And it imposed upon the world a great peace that enabled the travel that Paul was able to do when he came to the New Testament time. I mean, the world was in such turmoil until the Romans established, Augustus came to power, and man, everything just settled right down just in time for Christ and the apostles to go about all the world preaching the gospel. It's just astounding. Now, the feet was iron and miry clay, which I suggested last week, and I don't want to be dogmatic, but I suggested last week to think of that miry clay as the Jews among the Roman Empire. They never really mixed in. They kept a separate existence. And the gospel would go from the synagogue then out to the Roman citizens. And so it was, if anything would represent miry clay, I think it would be Jews. Now that's not really ever brought out in the text and all, so I'm going to say that's another thing. I like the arms. That's kind of my thoughts on this. But it does fit. Now, what we're going to do is go from history, which you have go from prophecy, which is a prehistory of this period between the Testaments. And then we're going to go into history and see some of the things that happened and fill in details. I'm going to be going back and forth in this. And I'm not sure where to tell some of those historic stories because there's so much in here. But I'll try to see tonight where that'll take us. This is where we have been If you had been with us in the last quarter, we had 13 lessons on the 12 historical periods of the Old Testament. Now, a lot of that is somewhat familiar to most of us, I would think. We just skimmed only 45 minutes for 1,650 years. You know, we just had to kind of skim through these period between the Testaments, historical periods in the Old Testament. But look at those years. Look at the years involved. Now, these numbers are estimate, okay? They're not... That 215 is probably pretty exact, but most of these, I kind of rounded off to give you an estimate. It's going to amount to a little over 4,000 years that we have from the creation to the time of Christ. Now, that's, again, let me emphasize, that's not an exact figure, but then to understand the extent of this period between the Testaments, if that's 4,000 years, this is 1/10 of that time. You might think of it like a clock. We're in the last hour and 15 minutes, say, of that whole time that's in there. So it's a lengthy time that comes right at the end of all of this, and that's why I put the number of years involved in those historic periods. I'm going to carry us back a little bit tonight. We'll go all the way back to the divided kingdom because I want to show you some things that are going to take place to help appreciate how vastly different the Old Testament culture is compared to the New Testament culture. And you'll see what I'm talking about when I get there. Let me go back. I used this last week. Ezekiel chapter 21. 26 and 27, where the prophet said, I will overturn it. And I use the illustration of a farmer plowing his field, plows it one way, plows it another way. He's going to dig, he's going to harrow, he's going to deep plow. He gets that and where that field is completely changed from what it was into a field, the ground that is ready to sow the seed of the gospel. And so overturn it. My understanding of this prophecy at this time is it is messianic. Look, I will overturn it, and it shall be no more till he come whose right it is, and I will give it to him. It's my understanding at this time, and I'm humbled when I get into these prophets, I think it's talking about Christ. When he gives that kingdom to Christ at the end of all this. Now, that's kind of a review. So here we are now. I'm going to show you some maps. The divided kingdom. I look up, I don't have a pointer, do I? I may have to just get up and point to some things, okay? I don't have some, I'll point with this maybe. Kind of show you some stuff as we get up there. But can you see the little kingdoms around Israel? Now this is the divided kingdom. The tribes to the north called Israel. The tribes to the south called Judah. It was mostly the tribe of Judah. The Levites had come down. Benjamin was part of it. It's because it was called Judah that they referred to them as the Jews, you see, instead of the Israelites. So you got the northern kingdom. But then look at all these little kingdoms all around this. And we've read about these in the Old Testament and David's wars with them and the judges having battles with Philistia and Edom and Moab and Ammon. And then it's got Aram up there. I've probably written Syria up there with Damascus. Phoenicia, that's Tyre and Sidon. You read more about Tyre and Sidon than Phoenicia. But all these little kingdoms round about. I wouldn't want to throw in the desert down there south of Judah, the Amalekites. I'd want to bring into this, coming across into northern Israel and down along the coast, the Hittites that were there. Go right out in the middle around Jerusalem, the Jebusites. You've heard of all these little kingdoms, these little, and they're just small little kingdoms. Now they sound huge, you know, a kingdom, but they're just little groups of people all around it. And that is the bulk of Old Testament history with Israel. You got all these little kingdoms. By the time the Lord overturns it, they're going to be gone. And those aren't the people that Israel has to deal with anymore. They're going to be taken away. You don't read anything about Philistines in the New Testament, do you? They're going to be completely done away with in this period between the Testaments. I'll explain how Assyria gave them a heavy blow. Babylon really took them down. And then Alexander the Great came by and took them out. And there's no Philistines. Those people are gone. And so also all these other kingdoms, they lose their identity. In fact, they would come in and take people, just gather up all the population and move them away so that they weren't even in that land, and bring other peoples in to their place to settle there as they rearranged the world, those conquerors, one after another. Now, here's what we have. The Assyrians. Now, before the Assyrians, there was the old Babylonian Empire. And we read about this all the way back into the book of Genesis. You know, the Tower of Babel and all of that. And that empire continued. There's probably one of that and Egypt. Egypt over here, and then the Babylonian Empire over here, and Israel in between. That land of Canaan that was kind of on one side you had a desert. On the other side you had an ocean. And to get from that old Babylonian kingdom from the Tigris Euphrates to the Egyptian kingdom along the Nile, you were forced into this little narrow streak of land along the Mediterranean Sea and beside the great Arabian desert, that little fertile strip that where Israel is. I mean, it's right in the middle of things. And so a lot takes place between these kingdoms and Israel. But then the Assyrians come to rule. And they completely overthrow those Babylonians. And now we're dealing not with little petty kingdoms like Moab and Ammon and Edom and Philistia. Now you're dealing with an empire that Israel is going to contend with. After the Assyrians come the Babylonians. After them come the Persians, and then the Greeks and the Romans. That part in blue is actually the period between the Testaments. It's the late Persian era where it begins. There's about 200 years of Persian rule after Malachi. And then there is the Roman period, which you've got about 100 years of Roman rule before we come to the New Testament. And so we're talking about this period of the Persians, mostly the Greeks, and the Greeks are going to play such an important role in this period between the Testaments, and then the Romans come in after that, and then the New Testament. So that's what the blue line there signifies. And then tell you about Assyria. Yes, I need to move over. Okay, sorry. Now you have to see me. But let me look at that. I want you to look at the little dark green part in the middle. And you might see in the middle of that Nineveh kind of written up there. And there is Asher. Asher is the city that started the, you know, people were ruled by city states. It was really a city that was ruling everything. Well, it started with Asher. That's why they called the Assyrians, because of Asher. But that capital moved to Nineveh. And when you've got Asher and Nineveh in there, you see that little dark cream spot? And that's where Assyria began to really exert itself. A lot of these kingdoms in history, these empires, they didn't really start off to be empires. It's like, well, now look, to take care of this, we got competition over there. We better go take that. And then they're more powerful, but now they've got other competition, and we got to get that. And they just kind of accidentally grew into empires, because if they didn't, they were afraid others would come in on them. That's what happened to the Assyrians. They just went out, and these Assyrians, they were so cruel. I mean, they come in, and there was no mercy. That's one of the things Assyrians known for in history. They're the kind of folks that come into a city And every man would have his head cut off, and they'd make piles of heads outside the city gates. You know, I mean, that's how they, when they came in to conquer, boy, they were cruel in their conquest. And they grew. You see the larger, lighter green from that dark green. And I want you to see how this kind of like filling up, like filling the sink, or it's like floodwaters rising. The Syria grows there. And then it grows further. And when the Syria grew to its peak, it had overflown into parts of Asia Minor. It was down to the Persian Gulf, and it spilled over into Egypt. I want to tell you a story. Maybe I'll tell you later one of the stories about Egypt. It's just almost haunting what happens. But that would be the high water mark of the kingdom of Assyria. And this shows it encompassing Jerusalem. But Sennacherib was not able to take Jerusalem. He took every other city. He was undefeated until he came to Jerusalem. And before he was able to come to Jerusalem, we read about that angel that came down among and slew his army. They woke up next morning, they were all dead corpses. Well, Sennacherib, he thought, enough of this. He'd already challenged them, saying, you better just surrender. Don't you listen to Hezekiah. But the next morning, his army was dead. Well, he got back to Nineveh and Asher and made sacrifices to his false gods, and he was slain in his temple. That's the high water mark of Assyria. And so I want you to think of a flood coming up, and it comes up, and it comes right up to Jerusalem, and it didn't take Jerusalem. That's when the kingdom began to subside. And that's how Isaiah describes it. In Isaiah chapter 8, Isaiah was there. Now, he wasn't there yet, but he's going to be there if you keep reading into Isaiah. Isaiah is there in 38, 39, right around there. He's going to talk about Sennacherib coming, but before it happened, he was saying this, "Now therefore, behold, the Lord bringeth up upon them the waters of the river, strong and many, even the king of Assyria and all his glory. And he shall come up over all his channels and go over all his banks." You've seen the flood waters rise. That's what happens. "And it shall pass through Judea, and he shall overflow and go over, and he shall reach even up to the neck." I tell you, when you're in water that deep, you're pretty deep. That's as far as it gets. The head is Jerusalem. Comes up to the neck, but it doesn't take Jerusalem. And the waters subside. "The stretching out of his wings shall fill the breadth of thy land, O Emmanuel." See, he had told Ahab about that sign. Emmanuel, God will be with us. And that took care of the kings that were coming after King Ahaz. Not Ahab, Ahaz. But when the Assyrians would come, he would remind Hezekiah, listen, they're going to come right up to the neck. God is with us. And so Jerusalem does not fall to the Assyrians, although Hezekiah does pay tribute to them after that. All right? Now, next comes Babylon. Babylon is the kingdom of Nebuchadnezzar. Now, his father, Nebuchadnezzar, began this conquest, but Nebuchadnezzar took the reins at the death of his father, and Nebuchadnezzar made Babylon the great kingdom that it was. And after him, there was no king so great as Nebuchadnezzar. There were other kings that came after him, but they were not competent and mighty and skillful in administration and conquest like Nebuchadnezzar. And if you'll see, it's much the same land area, isn't it? I mean, you see that. Nebuchadnezzar shows it more out here in Arabia. This Babylonian Empire, they did take Egypt. Now, they didn't quite show that there. It looks like Egypt is a little different color on this map. Nebuchadnezzar did not take Egypt, but Egypt was taken by those Babylonians. And then, you look off that wasn't captured. You see the Median Empire? And you see below that Persia. That's the Medes and the Persians. As Babylon grew, the Medes and the Persians felt threatened. And so, to save themselves, they went in to kind of pull the cork on Babylon. They didn't want Babylon conquering them as they had those other kingdoms. But look, it takes the island of Cyprus, and it goes again. You see Lydia? Lydia up there, the white Lydia? That's what we would call Asia Minor. Remember Lydia. Lydia's going to play important. Asia Minor was called Lydia back then. You remember the Lydia in the New Testament over in Philippi? Okay, probably named for this region. You know, Lydia, that's where she was from, over here in this area. We call it Asia Minor in the New Testament. So the Babylonians come up. Now, Nebuchadnezzar, here's what happened. It's up here. Oh, I don't think it has. Yeah, Carchemish. Do you see Carchemish? Up here. Right up there. Carchemish. That's a very important battle took place. That's when the Egyptians said, we've had enough of this. They're going out after the Babylonians. They meet it. Carchemish. Remember, that's when Josiah was slain, trying to help the Egyptians. King Josiah, that good king. But he got caught up helping those Egyptians and got slain. That's when Egypt, they took their tails and ran back to Egypt. And that's when Babylon said, it's ours now. We don't even have competition out of Egypt anymore. And all the cities surrender to Babylon. And when they do, he says, okay, you're going to surrender to me. Give me your choices, young men, as a pledge of your surrender. And that's when Daniel, in 605, 600 years before the New Testament now, that's when Daniel is taken into Babylon. But a few years later, they rebel. And he comes back and takes more people away. He takes not just the choice. He takes many people out of Jerusalem. And he takes some of the priests. And that's when Ezekiel, that's about, what is that, 7 years later? That's when Ezekiel goes into captivity. But then they rebel again about 10 years later. And Jeremiah is the prophet in that last rebellion. He's in Jerusalem. He's warning them, you better just surrender to him. And they take him as a traitor and throw him in a pit, you know. But sure enough, they come and they destroy Jerusalem and destroy the temple. We've had enough of this. This city is no more. And so they take that third wave of captivity. And so in those three waves, they take the Jews out of Jerusalem and destroy the city and destroy the temple. And those are the main prophets. Daniel, Ezekiel, Jeremiah, and then the 70 years of Babylonian captivity. Now, 150 years before, while Isaiah, during the days of Hezekiah, when the threat was from the Assyrians, 150 years before, Isaiah warns of Persia coming in. And it says, Jerusalem, thou shalt be inhabited. Now they're in the captivity, but just think, it'd be 100 years before the Nebuchadnezzar took them away. They had their scroll. They take the scroll with them into captivity. And in their meetings, their assemblies, which is the meaning of the word synagogue, assembly, they would open that scroll of Isaiah. And Isaiah told them, it's not over for you. God has not forgotten you. He hasn't forsaken you. And he says, Jerusalem, thou shalt be inhabited. And the cities of Judah, you shall be built, and I will raise up the decayed places thereof, that saith to the deep, be dry, and I'll dry up the rivers, that saith of Cyrus, he is my shepherd, and shall perform all my pleasure, even saying to Jerusalem, thou shalt be built, and to the temple, thy foundation shall be laid. Next chapter, look what he says. This is chapter 4, beginning of 45. That's the end of 44, beginning of 45. Thus saith the Lord to his anointed, to Cyrus. That word anointed, the word Messiah. The New Testament word is Christ. He's not talking about Jesus Christ. He's talking about Cyrus Christ. He said, thus saith the Lord to his anointed, to Cyrus. He called him a shepherd. Now he calls him the Christ. Okay. Whose right hand I have holden to subdue nations before him. I'll loose the loins of kings to open for him the two lead gates, and the gates shall not be. I'm going to open the door and let him come through, is what he's saying. I'll go before thee and make the crooked places straight. I'll break in pieces the gates of brass and cut in sunder the bars of iron. And I'll give thee the treasures of darkness and hidden riches of secret places, that thou mayest know that I, the Lord, which called thee by thy name, am the God of Israel. Josephus tells us that the Persian Cyrus, when he came to power, Josephus says the Jews carried him the scroll of Isaiah and said, Cyrus, 100 years before you, look what, 150, 170 years, look what our prophet said. And Cyrus, Josephus says, Cyrus read the scroll, and there he was named in that. And it came to pass, just, and he believed in the God of Israel. Now he believed other gods as well. But Josephus says that's one of the reasons he decided to let Israel go home. Because of what Isaiah. And isn't that what he said? That thou mayest know that I, the Lord, which called me by name, am the God of Israel. That's why skeptics say that Isaiah didn't write that. Because they say he couldn't have known that. Isaiah has many chapters talking about how, like, you know, the idols, they couldn't know that, but Jehovah knows. God knows, and that's how you know I'm not like those idols. Because those dumb idols can't tell you anything, but I can tell you what's going to come to pass. And that's what happened. So, here's the Persian Empire. It is much, much larger than the Assyrians or than the Babylonians. I want you to look right here to see how much larger it is. The other empires were this right here. Look what the Persians did. I mean, they're all the way over here to India. And they didn't just conquer part of Lydia. They're all the way across Lydia into Macedonia. And they come down here into Egypt. So this is the high water mark of the Persian Empire. Now, it's got Greece out here in green. Oh, that's going to be such a... They didn't quite take Greece. They occupied Athens, but they couldn't keep it. And when I get there, I'll tell you that story. The hand of God is involved in what happens there. In the two invasions of the Persians into Greece that failed. That one little city-state, Athens, stood up against this greatest empire that ever been on the world and stopped them. Well, it's a fascinating story. And the explanations for it are fascinating too. Now, we read in Ezra during this time about some of these Persian kings, Zerubbabel and Joshua, that'd be Joshua. Okay, they're the first ones that come over and they lay the foundation of the temple as Cyrus, the king of Persia, had commanded us. We read further into the book of Ezra about Cyrus, king of Persia. The king that followed him is Darius. The king that follows him is Ahasuerus. In the history books, he is the Xerxes. The Hebrew form of the Greek name, the Greeks called him the Xerxes. The Hebrew form of that Greek name translated into English comes out Ahasuerus. I know it doesn't sound that much alike, but that's how they explain it. You know, names kind of change through language. Did you know Guillermo? You ever heard of Guillermo? That's William in Spanish, I think. So the names can really change like that, you know. Well, that's how that is. He's Xerxes. History knows him as Xerxes. The Bible knows him as Ahasuerus. And then Artaxerxes Artaxerxes. Well, these are these Persian kings, and they're named in Ezekiel. See, Ezra goes all the way into the room of Artaxerxes. We're going to see this. Here's what happened. Cyrus, he comes up. Go home and build your temple. So Zerubbabel and Joshua, sometimes called Joshua. Now, this isn't the Joshua that followed Moses. This is Joshua the high priest. Zerubbabel is of the line of David, but he was never a king. But that man and Joshua come over, and they just like that, and they'll lay the foundation thereof. Well, that's what they did under Cyrus. They laid the foundation, just like Isaiah said, but that's as far as they got. They didn't finish. Cyrus dies in Cambyses. His son rules. And he says, I'm going to take Egypt. And so he went down and he conquered Egypt. Here's a strange story. He decided to go home. I think this is the one. He decided he'd go home after he took Egypt, but he left an army of 50,000 men and says, I want you to take Carthage. Well, you know, Carthage is way over there, past Italy, but it's on the African coast. He sent an army of 50,000 men off into the desert to take Carthage, and nothing was ever heard of them again. They've never found any signs or any remnant of a 50,000 man army that just disappeared into the desert sands of North Africa. Isn't that fascinating? Well, anyway, he's on his way back home, and he had killed his brother. Cambyses had. He killed his brother because he was afraid he would try to usurp the throne. On his way back home, or he had his brother killed anyway, he tried to pretend like he didn't have anything to do with it. But on his way home, he found out his brother was ruling up back in Shushan, the palace. Well, it wasn't his brother, but he didn't know that. And some say he killed himself. Others say he just wounded himself with his own equipment trying to mount a horse. But he died before he got back there. And it wasn't his brother. It was this guy, Gautama, pretending to be his brother. And Darius, he wasn't going to have that. He knew better. And he got rid of him. And now Darius becomes the king. And under him, they say, look, the Lord said we could build our temple. Well, he checked the records. Well, yeah, you can. Go build it. So Haggai and Zechariah show up in Jerusalem and chastise the people for their laziness. You're living in sealed houses, and look, we don't have a temple. And so they finish building the temple after that. And then after he dies, Ahasuerus becomes king. That's Xerxes, history calls him. This is the king Persia read about in the book of Esther, okay? And then after that, Artaxerxes becomes king. And these are the times of Ezra and Nehemiah, where they finally finished the temple and they rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. And after that, the prophet Malachi. So that's what's going on in the Persian kingdom. And this is what's going on in Israel. Now, the Old Testament does not end well. The walls of Jerusalem have been rebuilt. The temple has been rebuilt. But the people have not been reformed. And they're coming to the temple with the lame and the blind and the sick. That's what they're offering on the altar. They're bringing that which is contemptible to the altar and then standing back and saying, this is contemptible. Well, it's contemptible because it was contemptible that they brought to the... They brought contemptible sacrifice and then stood back and talked about how contemptible it was. Well, as hypocritical as it can be. And Malachi is saying, ye say, but God says, and he is chastised. You are robbing God in this. And Old Testament doesn't end well. It's a very troubled way to go into this 400 period of silence. But the last words of the Old Testament, found in Malachi 4, verses 4 through 5, Behold, I'll send you Elijah the prophet. Now, Elijah, buddy, he was one prophet. He stood right up against Ahab, you know, called the fire down from heaven and all that stuff. I'm going to send you a prophet like Elijah. And that's threatening. He said, I'll send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord. And he shall turn the heart of the fathers to the children and the heart of the children to their fathers. See, that's repentance. Lest I come and smite the earth with a curse. Curse. The last word. And then it's quiet. Curse. That idea of a curse echoes down through the corridors of time in that 400 years. The curse. The curse. And then we come to the New Testament. John the Baptist is preaching the kingdom of heaven is at hand. Jesus is preaching the kingdom of heaven is at hand. But we don't have the actual words of Jesus until we come to Matthew chapter 5. The Sermon on the Mount. What's the first word out of his mouth? Blessing. Blessing. The Old Testament to the New Testament. From the curse to the blessing. Blessed. Blessed what? Blessed are the poor in spirit. That's those humbled. They had been humbled by these empires overthrowing them, and they are now humbled. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Theirs is the kingdom of heaven. See, the kingdom of heaven is at hand. That stone coming out of the mountain without hands is going to smite that image in its feet. And so let's go from the Old Testament to the... How do we go from curse down through history to blessed in the New Testament? Of course, we know Elijah, that spirit and power Elijah's in John the Baptist. So these prophets told them what was going to happen. And then we're going to get to the New Testament and see it happen. And we're going to look at these times between and help understand some of these things that take place. After the Persians come the Greeks. Look at the size of that empire. We call this the Greek Empire. Perhaps we should call it the Macedonian Empire. Down in Greece, Athens had defeated the Persians in two great campaigns. And Athens was the chief city of Achaia, that's Greece, and wanted to unite all the Greek cities under the power of Athens. Well, Sparta, they didn't want to do that. They weren't going to go along with that. And Sparta, and then they divided up between the Greeks and the Spartans. They had a big war. Well, the Spartans said, we'll unite them all under Sparta. Well, they didn't want to unite under Sparta. We're all independent Greek cities. Well, they had another big war with Sparta. And then Thessaly says, we'll unite them all under Thessaly. Well, that didn't get anywhere. We're not going to kowtow to Athens or Sparta or Thessaly. Everything they tried to unite themselves failed until they just beat themselves to death. And then out of Macedonia comes King Philip. And he walks in there and they are so exhausted and beat up after all these 100 more years of fighting that he can just take them. But what Philip did was amazing. Philip said, all right, I got you now. And they thought, oh boy, what is he going to do? He says, I'm going to leave you alone. I'm going to let you take care of yourselves. You do it like you want to, just as long as you unite under me. And all the Greeks said, well, that sounds like a pretty good deal. It was Philip the Macedonian that united the Greeks. And his dream was to take on Persia. But he died, and Alexander the Great did it. He was about 20 years old when he began. He was in his early 30s when he drunk himself to death. But by that time, he had taken this empire. What Alexander the Great's going to do? Boy, I got just a few minutes. Here's what he's going to do. He comes through so fast that the Persians didn't know what to think about how these Greeks had got. He came through, they crossed Macedonia, they came through Lydia, and Lydia, see, all around the Aegean Sea there, around Lydia, this is the Aegean Sea. I don't know if I'm in your way to see that, but But these were all Greek cities. You know, he took over those Greek cities easy because they were Greeks anyway. But then he marched right across Lydia. He came through. He had a big battle with the Persians. And they took off. They said, man, we can't stand before this. And Alexander the Great, that great general, I mean, he's just a young man, but he was so wise militarily. He knew the first thing I got to do is protect my rear. So instead of taking out after the Persians, he went south, went down and took Tyre, Sidon, Jerusalem, and Egypt. And after he took Egypt, after he had all that taken, then he turned on the rest of the Persians. And he did it all so fast that the Persians never were able to rally and recover. And those Greeks had learned how to fight because they'd been fighting each other. And the Persians, they'd gotten lazy and lax. And boy, those Greeks just ran over them. So there's the Greek Empire. But then after the Greeks conquered, and Alexander, I like to think about Alexander. Oh, my time's almost up. Alexander, he could conquer the world, but he couldn't conquer himself. And he drunk himself to death in Babylon. And the story is, and it may be legend, but the generals gathered around and said, to whom do you leave your kingdom? And he said, to the strongest. And he passed away. And so they got together and divided things up. Boy, they fought with one another. Okay, so you had the four kingdoms come up. The Seleucids over there toward the east. The Lycomachus, I think that's how you'd pronounce his name. Seleucus, Lycomachus, he took care of Lydia and Asia Minor, that area. Cassander took care of the Greeks and Macedonia. And then the Ptolemies took care of Egypt. Now here's the thing to remember. These are not the Syrians and the Egyptians and the people from Asia Minor. They're all Greeks. They're all Greeks. These are Greeks and Greeks. Now they're have different bases of thought, but they've conquered this land, but they're all Greeks. And then come the Romans. And about 100 years before the New Testament, I think it's in the year 64, when Pompey comes to Jerusalem. And the Romans take over, and there's the iron rule of Rome. And look, it goes all the way to Hadrian's Wall, between England and Scotland, and all across northern Africa, and it didn't go as far east. And so the attention of the world had gone from the east to the west, and I'm out of time. I'm going to remember that. That's where we're going to begin next week about these empires, and then we're going to go back into Daniel and see another prophecy of Daniel. He'll give us another layer of information about what takes place here. Okay?